the second case for oral argument this morning is the International Union of Operating Engineers Appellant versus the City of Pierre, Appalachia. For the appellant, we have Mr. Todd Love, an attorney from Pierre, and for the appellee, we have Mr. A. Stevenson Bogue, an attorney from Omaha, Nebraska. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself from this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Stephen Jensen, the presiding judge of the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Zinner's place. Mr. Love, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Justices, at issue in this case is a question of law. It's a question of statutory interpretation. This court reviews de novo. It's a question of the proper procedures to be employed in public union collective bargaining negotiations. More specifically, it's a question of whether the City of Pierre, the public employer at issue in this case, was required by South Dakota statutes to participate in conciliation and fact-finding intervention procedures with the South Dakota Department of Labor prior to unilaterally imposing a contract upon the union employees, the union members here in Pierre. The facts that led up to the dispute here today are not in dispute. The International Union of Operating Engineers, Local Number 49, is the collective bargaining representative for two groups of employees here in the City of Pierre. One group consists of the police department and the police dispatchers. The other group consists of the civilian employees of the City of Pierre, with the exception of the police and the electrical department. For approximately the last 5 years, the union has been the recognized bargaining representative. Prior to the year in dispute here, the city and the union have bargained to completed contracts. This case is about procedure. A few of the procedural facts that I believe are relevant here. This dispute arises out of the contract between the unions and the City of Pierre that it was due to begin January 1, 2010. In August of 2009, the parties began negotiations for that contract. The parties met approximately 8 to 10 times between August of 2009 and the end of the year. They had not reached an agreement. On December 30th of that year, 2009, the city presented to the union a complete contract for both of the union groups. There were further meetings in 2010, in January and February of 2010. At these meetings, the union made various proposals to attempt to reach some kind of negotiated resolution of this matter.
When did the prior contract run out?
By its terms, it would have run out at the end of 2009. This was supposed to start the first of 2010.
What happened between January and April then?
The parties were continuing operation under the terms of the old contract.
And is that what you're advocating here should have continued to happen?
Yes. I think that what the law says is that that during the negotiations phase, the parties are, assuming it runs over like it did in this case, that the parties continue to operate under the terms of the old contract during the negotiations phase until they reach whatever agreement they reach or a contract is imposed in some manner. So, yes, they continue to operate under the terms of the 2009 contract up until the contract was imposed here in April of 2010. And during early 2010, there were, again, a number of meetings. It came to a head in April of 2010. At that time, at April 13th and 14th of 2010, there were further negotiation sessions. Nothing was ratified at that point in time. Bob Ryder, the chief negotiator for the city, informed Gil Ketzel, the chief negotiator for the unions, that the parties were at impasse. Mr. Ketzel requested that impasse notice be provided in writing in order to comply with the Department of Labor intervention procedures, specifically SDCL 318.18, 318.8.1, which requires a written notice to begin a 10-day procedure to implement those Department of Labor procedures.
So the city did participate, is that correct, in the conciliation?
After they imposed the contract, yes, they did.
Right. There's some indication here, though, that the stance the city took is that they didn't even have to participate in conciliation.
I believe that is the stance they took, that they didn't even have to do it. And in fact, they participated in the Department of Labor intervention procedures in June and July of 2010 under the proviso that they were not agreeing that they had to or not agreeing that they were waiving any rights. So, yes, I believe they did take the stance that they were not required to at all. That statute is one of the things, of course, that's at issue in this case. 318.8.1, it's not mandatory in the sense that if neither party requests intervention with the Department of Labor, they don't go to the Department of Labor. However, what those statutes say is that once either party exercises their right to request that intervention, that the department is obligated to attempt to go through a conciliation and a fact-finding procedure. And again, I think it was their position immediately that they didn't have to do that at all. Of course, it's our position not only that they have to do that, but they had to do that prior to implementing any contract.
Was it of any relevance that your old contract had already expired?
No, I don't believe it is. I believe
time was not of the essence.
No. They continue to operate under the terms of the old contract through the negotiation phase until that's resolved one way or another. If we go back to how this was implemented, I think it's rather important here. It was on April 20th at the City Commission meeting here in Pierre that the City Commissioners voted in an executive session to impose the contracts upon both of the union groups. They voted to impose that effective immediately. The next day, April 21st, I believe Mr. Ryder notified Mr. Kessel by telephone later that evening that they had done this. And then the next day is when letters were sent out to both of the union groups notifying them of the implementation of the contract. At that point, I mean, there's no dispute here between the parties that we were at impasse at that point. And that is why the union then proceeded to file the request with the Department of Labor. And, of course, the trial court found that they had properly and timely filed the request to proceed to the Department of Labor. A week later, it was April 27th, when the union applied to the circuit court for a temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction. The hearing was held in June of this year, or I'm sorry, June of last year, 2010, which brings us up to where we are today.
Back to the conciliation. Was there actually a conciliation meeting with the Department of Labor?
There was a conciliation meeting with the Department of Labor, and I believe that date was in June of 2010. Yes, June 14th of 2010.
And what happened at the meeting?
Nothing. The parties were not able to reach an agreement.
I mean, did they even talk or put out proposals or anything like that?
I believe they discussed their proposals. I wasn't personally present at the conciliation or the fact-finding meetings, but it's my understanding that, they at least discussed the issues and discussed proposals, but there was no agreement that was reached.
Did the department then issue findings?
The department did not issue written findings.
Is there a reason that was? Is it because of this lawsuit, or?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
All right.
So
go over the time frame again. When did you request the impasse or the Department of Labor's, when did you ask for the Department of Labor conciliation?
It was April 21st that they were notified that the contract was imposed, that was the impasse notification.
Okay, when did they impose the contract?
April 21st.
And when did you ask for the impasse?
It was within that 10-day period.
After they imposed it.
Yes, it was within that 10-day period. I guess I can't tell you the exact date, but I know the trial that was discussed in the trial court did find that they had met that 10-day procedural requirement. But as to the exact date, I guess, I'm sorry, I can't tell you the exact date.
But the city had notified the union that they were, that you were at an impasse.
Yes.
And that was the what? The
that was by letter on April 21st.
Okay, that was the April 21st date.
Correct.
And the contract was imposed prior to that?
Well, the contract was essentially yes. It was voted on the city commission on the 20th at their city commission meeting in, I think.
So it was imposed approximately the same time as the impasse was declared.
Exactly. I mean, let me back up just a second here. A week prior, at the April 14th sessions, there was a verbal notification that they were at impasse. Mr. Ketzel requested it be in writing because that's what the statute requires in order to start the time period. So it was actually put in writing on April 21st. Mm-hmm. That was the same day that the contract essentially took effect.
On the 21st?
Yes.
Just trying, looking at what you're asking for, really you're asking for a declaration from this court that the period of prior to an imposition of the contract that you have to wait until after the impasse hearing? Is that what it boils down to that you're asking for?
Yeah, exactly. That's
just
exactly.
Just a declaration to that effect?
Well, that's exactly what it boils down to. We're asking that this court tell the city of Pierre and any public employer that these Department of Labor procedures, once they're invoked, they can't unilaterally impose a contract until they go through the procedures, until they follow the procedure.
What would happen? Would you want the circuit court then to set aside the contract?
Well, I think the remedy has to be it has to go back to the circuit court. Yes,
there. To do what? What would the circuit court do in your view?
Well, what the circuit court would do is essentially determine what damages have accrued during this time period when they should not have imposed the contract, when we should have still been operating under the 2009 contract.
I mean, wouldn't the relief be that they'd have to go back, set aside the contract, and they'd have to go back and then? I mean, all the statute entitles you to is a conciliation. In your interpretation, a conciliation meeting before a contract's imposed. So wouldn't the only relief you get is that you set aside the contract, you go to your conciliation meeting, and if there's an impasse, then they can put the contract in place.
There's no doubt that they could. There's no doubt that they could, you know, go through the conciliation and impose the exact same contract. We're not arguing that they couldn't. You know, unfortunately, I know this court has noted that, what teeth there are in the law here, you know, may be a matter for dispute, but we recognize that's not a matter for dispute in this court.
All right, Mr. Lowe, just again looking at your remedy, and maybe I didn't get deep enough into it. It appears that the primary difference is a management rights clause.
No, not in this case. There were a number of factual issues in this case that were still in dispute at the time. The trial court's findings, indicate that they centered on issues of birthday leave, health insurance, longevity pay, overtime pay. There were a number of financial considerations that were still in dispute between the parties.
All right.
So, but yes, as for remedy, that is our request. That since they went through these procedures prior to the time that they should have him prior to. Since they imposed the contract prior to the time they went through those procedures, look at the position that it puts the union in. That's, part of our argument here is that, the union doesn't have the opportunity to go through these conciliation of fact-finding procedures on any kind of a level playing field. We realize, what the ultimate outcome might be, but we have to go into the procedures on a fair and level playing field.
So basically you want us to give the parties some guidance for future negotiations, really, because in this case, we could be just marching everybody down the hill just to march right back up again.
Well, that's certainly part of the remedy that we're, of course, looking for in this case. This is an issue that has come up and is going to come up again. you know, as to what, you know, as to whether the city has to, or county or any public employer has to go through these procedures or not. If they're allowed to bypass them, you know, again, look at what it does to the union bargaining position. Quite frankly, I think it's almost a matter of common sense. If the city,
I want to go back to the statute. You've not alleged that the city didn't negotiate in good faith.
We didn't make that argument in this case. We're making the, we are making the argument that they have to follow the procedures.
Right. So you've not alleged a lack of good faith. You've not alleged, or you've admitted that, that there was an impasse.
Yes.
What specific statutory language then would you point to that would say, rather than imposing a unilateral contract at that point, the city has to go through the Department of Labor conciliation process? What language specifically says that?
I would point out two things. Number one, you know, quite frankly, the city's right. Is there language in the statute that says you have to follow, that specifically says you are barred from imposing before you go through this procedure? No, there isn't. If you read the statutes, though, and you read the case law that this court has put out, specifically the Bonhomme County case that's cited in the briefs, I think what the trial court's error here was is it took the some of the language in Bonhomme County and misinterpreted the procedural position that it should be placed in. If I can explain just briefly what that case said. This court in Bonhomme County case, this court specifically laid out a procedure that needs to be followed in these types of cases. What this court specifically said is that if the negotiations are not successful, 318.8.1 permits either party to request Department of Labor conciliation. When those efforts do not result in an agreement, either party may request the department investigate and go through the fact-finding procedures. It says if an agreement still remains unattainable, South Dakota law provides that a public employer may unilaterally implement the disputed provisions. Okay? So there's a procedure that's set out that follows these statutes. The specific statutes, if you look at 318.8.1, what it says, it gives the parties the right to implement or to request the Department of Labor procedures. Those procedures in 60-10 are specifically referenced in 318.8.1. They were specifically adopted by reference into this Public Employee Union Act. The city's position here that they don't have to go through them at all not only makes the statute meaningless, it makes the entire procedure meaningless. It makes the reference in that statute to the Department of Labor procedures completely meaningless. Now, what the court did, or what the trial court did in this case, is that they, I think, improperly looked at the next statute, 318.8.2. If we try to keep the procedure correct here and in the correct order as I see it, the parties will negotiate on their own. The parties will, assuming they reach an impasse, go to the Department of Labor. Once the Department of Labor has gone through its fact-finding and its conciliation procedures, the parties, the employer, assuming they have not reached an agreement, is allowed under current law to unilaterally impose a contract. Now, they're allowed to. They're not required to. In fact, this court in the Bonhomme County case specifically addressed that. One of the things the trial court did in the Bonhomme County case is it ordered the employers in that case to impose their last best offer. This court said that that's not the rule. That's not the general rule. They're not required to impose a last best offer. They wouldn't be required, quite frankly, to impose any offer or whatever contract terms they so desire. What the statute, what 318.8.2 that the trial court relied on did is said, in the case of school district public employers, we don't want you operating without a contract. We're going to require that once you complete those Department of Labor procedures, that you impose the last best offer. That comes later in the procedure, after the Department of Labor procedures are done. It's telling the school districts you can't just leave them out there with no contract. That's not the case here. Again, the city in this case would not have been required under current law to impose the last best offer. That applies only to school districts. What the trial court did is it said, well, there's this exception that applies only to school districts. And then it read it backwards into an earlier procedural posture and said that because there's this exception for school districts, that means that any non-school district public employee union is not bound by any of the prior statutes or any of the prior procedure. It leads to a rather anomalous position as I see it. The Bonhom County case is a case involving non-school district public employers. What the trial court said is because you cited to a school district case when laying out the procedure, it means that this non-school district case does not apply to non-school districts.
Thank you, Mr. Love. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bogue, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Bogue. I represent the city of Pier, the appellee in this matter. I think the issue was properly framed by counsel for the union. This is a pure matter of statutory interpretation, the statute in question being 3-18-8.1. And it's important to emphasize at the outset a point that was made as a result of a question from the court. This is not an unfair labor practice case. It was not alleged that the city bargained in bad faith. And in fact, Judge Wilbur, the judge in the court below, specifically found that throughout the proceedings, the city of Pier had bargained in good faith. The focus of this matter, then, should be on the wording of 3-18-8.1. And counsel for the union seems to have conceded there is no language in that statute, nor the statutes it references and incorporates, which would require the city to wait until conciliation or to wait until fact-finding before imposing its last offer. One of the statutes...
Was the contract that was imposed here the last best offer?
It was indeed, Your Honor. There were only four issues that were at play in this matter from the 30th of December 2009 until the actual date of imposition. And I think it's illustrative to look at what happened during those intervening 4 months. On about the 10th of March, the city sent a letter to the union saying, we're at impasse. Now, the union contacted the city and asked them to come back to the table. And out of respect for the bargaining procedure, the city came back to the table. But that was a wake-up call at that point in time. Part of the language in the brief submitted by the union and in counsel's argument was that they lost leverage. What it neglects to indicate is that on the 10th of March, the city gave notice that bargaining was very near deadlock. In the succeeding negotiating meetings, nothing happened. The union didn't change its bargaining procedure. It didn't change its proposal. It didn't moderate. It didn't compromise. It didn't offer new proposals. After going back to the two futile bargaining meetings in April, the city decided to impose its last offer. And obviously it did so without having gone through conciliation, but it did proceed to do so. The parties did go through conciliation, as a result of which nothing really occurred. The parties beyond that then went through fact-finding, and a written finding was issued thereafter, although that finding is not a part of the record.
When you have an impasse, that sort of the word itself indicates that things are at a stalemate.
Correct.
And that nothing should happen until you go through the conciliation. I mean, that is one way you can interpret this statute, isn't it? I mean, if you say, well, we're at an impasse, but we're going to go ahead and just we're going to go ahead and impose a contract. And yes, you did the last best offer, but that you wouldn't have needed to. If, under your theory, you could offer any. You could just impose any kind of contract.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think as a result of going to impasse, and you're right, impasse does result. It's deadlock. The parties are at deadlock.
And but normally when you have something like that and you go to another level of court or here as an agency, everything kind of is on hold, the hold harmless, until that process works its way out. Isn't that normally how you would do it?
No, Your Honor. In the private sector, certainly, to use that as an example, when the parties reach impasse, impasse is impasse and the parties are free to proceed thereafter. I think the only difference between the private sector procedure and the procedure for public employees in South Dakota is found in the Public Employee Bargaining Act, and more specifically, 3-18-8.1. And there's nothing in that act indicating that impasse doesn't mean what its normal meaning would be, and that is the parties are at deadlock and may proceed. If there had been language in this statute similar to the language in the California cases, which were cited by the union in its brief, which require the parties to participate in conciliation, we'd concede the point.
Well, are you saying then that that statute really has no effect at all and the city of Pierre could have just thumbed their nose and said we're not going to participate?
I think there's nothing...
Are you asking us to approve that?
I am, Your Honor, because the wording of the statute provides that that is the situation with respect to the statute.
So why would the legislature put something like that on the books if nobody has to abide by it?
Because I think the legislature recognized that under the South Dakota public bargaining law, the union can file, and could have filed in this case, an unfair labor practice charge saying that the city had bargained in bad faith by not undertaking several acts, one of many acts, one of which would be not going through conciliation.
Okay, so by refusing to do it, it would become a bad faith act.
That would be one of the elements that could be looked at, certainly not the only one. It's looked at in the context of the overall behavior of the parties. And that's why it's important to note that this case is really not that sort of a case where we have to look at the whole panoply of events that occurred in bargaining. It really has to do with the wording of that particular statute. But the reason I think this has taken 27 years to get to the court after the passage of 8.1 is that employers are generally will participate and generally understand that they may be subject to an unfair labor practice charge if they don't proceed. I think the interpretation that you just mentioned, Your Honor, is one which would help, in a way, the Department of Labor do their job. Because as it currently stands, either party may request conciliation. The parties then may go into conciliation, one or the other knowing that there is no chance to proceed. The conciliator arrives and says, have you changed your position? No, I haven't. Have you changed your position? No, I haven't. 20 minutes, the mediation's over. I think what the statute provides for, read in its current light, is that both of the parties have to go through futile procedures, procedures not designed to lead to an agreement simply because they want to avoid an unfair labor practice or they want to posture it in public.
But normally, I mean, I guess from my experience in the Department of Labor is that there were usually findings then made, and I mean, there was an attempt. And then if you still were at loggerheads, the hearing examiner or whatever, whoever would be the conciliator, would actually make findings. And if it would say, you know, the finding might be that the union is totally unreasonable or that you're unreasonable in this, and make those kinds of findings, which then in themselves could prompt an agreement. That's, I mean, are you saying that's just, they don't need to do that?
Well, I'm saying
everybody could just say, well, every public entity could just say, well, we're not going to conciliate at all.
I think if every public entity did that, there would be more unfair labor practices filed, and the employers are going to recognize the cost of defending against an unfair labor practice, if nothing else, and proceed to conciliation, knowing they can go into conciliation, sit down, say our position hasn't changed, and the conciliation has ended. There are two parts to the procedure that occurs after 8.1 is invoked. The first is conciliation, which is, as I have described, the conciliator walks in and says, has your position changed, and they try to get the parties together. Nothing in the interpretation we would urge upon the court interferes with that. Section 60.10-1 simply says that the Department of Labor shall endeavor upon request to conciliate the parties. That's going to still be in play, and the conciliator is going to make that phone call or talk to the parties and get them to conciliate. And in most cases, they'll probably sit down and meet. The next step at 10.2 is the fact-finding that you described, Your Honor. And it's at that second stage that the parties present their views on the offers and the administrative law judge picks that offer that he or she thinks best. They send a copy to the local newspapers and allow the parties to circulate it if they wish. That happened here. There were findings made. The record doesn't reflect what happened because it occurred after the hearing in the court below. So that much can happen.
But isn't that really kind of all moot at that point? I mean, if the city's already unilaterally imposed its contract and said, here is the contract, what's left to conciliate? What's left to make fact findings on? There's no impasse, is there?
Well, there
contract's in place.
There would still be an impasse, as there is in every occasion before the intervention of the Department of Labor is contacted. So an impasse would still exist. And the parties, it seems to me, could still use the findings of fact, which came from the administrative law judge, to try to pressure the public employer to change their position at that time. But yeah, at that point in time, the last offer has been imposed. But it seems to me that the linchpin of the consideration as to whether that's appropriate gets back inextricably to the language of 8.1. And in 8.1 and the statute cited therein, there is no mandatory language requiring the union or the employer to wait until conciliation or fact-finding before implementing its last offer. Here's the difference in this case from the other cases I would suspect in the last 27 years. Of the last four issues which were on the table, and they were on the table for a period of 4 months before there was implementation, the implementation of each of those proposals would have resulted in the diminution of benefits of city employees. So make no mistake, the game that was being played here was a stall tactic. It was the four corners offense, because the union recognized that when those last four issues were placed in effect as a part of the contract, its members would have their benefits diminished. So in my view, they played a game to stall this as long as they could.
Well, with any of this, all you're asking us to do is interpret statute,
correct.
Not what happened in this case.
Correct.
It could be the other way, too.
Correct. That is correct. And it's just an explanation of how we got here, not necessarily an explanation that would change the interpretation of the statute, because as this court has said time and time again, the first place to go when interpreting a statute is its own wording. And when one looks at 8.1 and the two statutes cited thereunder, again, there is a complete absence of mandatory language requiring the parties to wait until conciliation or fact-finding to put their last offer into effect. Now, the legislature may come down and change that next session or this session, but it is submitted that it's a matter for the legislature to consider because it involves a complete change in the course, a change in the rights of employers, a change in the rights of unions. And it seems to me that the legislature did something very close to that when it formulated 8.2, the companion statute, a part of the same public employers collective bargaining laws in 1988. The original statute was implemented in 1983. The legislature came back in 1988 and looked at the statute, it simply had to, then formulated 8.2, which carries three mandates with it. First, that the last offer must be imposed. Second, that the entire last offer must be imposed.
That's for school districts.
That's for school districts.
Mm-hmm. If under your theory, then, if they put it in for the school districts, why didn't they put it in 8.1?
Correct, Your Honor.
So if it's not in 8.1, it's just as logical that they didn't intend that the last best offer. Otherwise, they would have put it in 8.1.
Correct. That's our position. And on the other hand, if it had believed the language in 8.1 already was mandatory, it wouldn't have needed to add the language it did to 8.2. That language would have been superfluous. So I think
Does it have something to do with the continuing contract law, though, with the teachers?
Part of it certainly does. Part of it certainly does, that being the requirement that the last offer must be put in effect and the whole offer. But the timing of it seems to me, is a slightly different element, and it's that point of 8.2 that we would point to the court as significant. I think it's striking, as a matter of fact, the difference in the wording between the two statutes, and I think one could conclude very easily and should conclude that by the failure to extend that same mandatory timing mechanism to 8.1, the legislature made a judgment that the parties could act as we urged the court to find they could act here today. Now, finally, I think there's one more issue that would relate to comments made in the argument by counsel that needs to be touched on, and that is, in this case, I don't think there was any irreparable injury, and I don't think there was any great loss of leverage in this case. Again, I would submit to the court, and this is outside statutory interpretation, I grant you that at the very outset, but the letter of early March that went out to the union telling them that impasse existed was a wake-up call. And if there were leverage to be imposed or to be used, it should have been used at that time. But instead, in the next two meetings, they were absolutely futile. No changes took place. Nothing took place. And when the parties finally did go through conciliation, nothing took place at the conciliation either. And I would suggest to you that isn't because of the lack of leverage on the part of the union. It's because the union was not going to agree to any of the four proposals. The parties had been at impasse for some time. And simply no movement would take. So I would submit to you that the implementation in this case made no difference. Based on the foregoing, and more specifically, the precise wording of the statutes in question, we would urge that this court uphold Judge Wilbur's finding in the court below that the petition should be dismissed. If the court has any further questions.
I do. I just have a comment. You know, we don't have binding arbitration.
Correct.
And the only statutory power that the South Dakota legislature has given public employee bargaining units is this statute on conciliation and allowing them to at least go to another party to try to work it out. If we follow yours, aren't we totally gutting that? Aren't we just saying now you really don't even have that because the city can say we're not going to participate?
I don't think you're gutting it. I think what you're doing is giving meaning to the very words of the statute, which don't have that mandatory adage in them. And I think secondarily...
Do you think the legislature meant something by that statute?
I think it meant that, much like the private sector, if the parties wish to access the Department of Labor, and if both parties believe there is an inkling of the possibility of an agreement, they'll go forward and participate in the procedure. And again, it's been in place for 27 years, and it's worked fairly well to this point in time. The legislature may disagree, and the legislature may at some point in time reconsider the wording of that statute and come down and change it and grant more rights or obligations than presently exist. But at this point in time, with all due respect, it seems to me that the chips will fall where they will with respect to the statute. But I'd reemphasize, I don't think it's going to change things. The Department of Labor will still endeavor to conciliate. And the Department of Labor will still contact the parties and try to get them to come together. And if the parties don't, the union can file an unfair labor practice alleging that as a part of an overall course of conduct, the public employer has not comported itself in good faith. And the public employer is going to have to litigate that. It's going to have to go through a lengthy process when that occurs. And I would submit to you that that by itself is going to be enough to drive most, if not all, employers to go through conciliation and fact-finding when the circumstances warrant. And when the circumstances, as in this case, indicate that there isn't probably after a certain point of time any effort to arrive at an agreement by the union, it allows the employer to implement its last proposal. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
I have one question with respect to the question was asked of Mr. Love about remedies.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take you where you don't want to go. Let's assume the court says the union's right on the statutory language. What's the remedy that this court would impose?
Well, it seems to me that there are probably two remedies. First is to send it back to the court below to fashion remedies, and the second would be to order the rescission, potentially, of the unilaterally implemented agreement. We would hope that that would not be the case because, given the current economic climate, that's a fairly draconian-type remedy, but one which Judge Wilbur, I would guess, would have to consider should the matter be remanded to her. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Bowe. Mr. Love, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, the only leverage that the union has under South Dakota law is the bargaining table. The legislature specifically took away public employee union members' rights to strike. The only leverage they have is sitting down at the bargaining table. We have to ask ourselves, what's the purpose of the conciliation and the fact-finding procedures? By its very definition, once an impasse is reached, the parties are at loggerheads. You know, bringing a third party, bringing a neutral party into the procedure to attempt to examine the situation, to examine the positions, to attempt to reach some kind of an agreement is the very purpose of the conciliation and the fact-finding procedures.
Okay, but assuming that's correct,
okay,
if a contract has already been imposed and then you go to conciliation process and then you go through the fact-finding, which can be used by either party, published in the paper, that doesn't keep the city and the union from changing whatever contract has been imposed, does it?
Perhaps not theoretically, Your Honor, but in reality, I would submit that it does. I mean, if you have one party going into the fact-finding and conciliation procedures, having already publicly imposed exactly what they wanted, and then go and sit down and say, okay, now let's negotiate, you know, what kind of a realistic position does it put them in? I would say, one, is it likely that you're going to get any kind of action from the Department of Labor that's going to result in any kind of agreement at that point? I'd say the reality of the situation is no. The purpose of bringing them into the conciliation fact-finding is to keep it on a level playing field, to keep the parties openly discussing the issues. you know, we're willing to presume, as you know, as a matter of any public employer, we should be willing to presume that they're going to go into these Department of Labor procedures with an open mind, with an honest effort to resolve the differences that they have. If one party, in this case the city of Pierre, has already said, no, we're at the end, we've imposed exactly what we want, the reality of getting any productive efforts from the Department of Labor, I would submit, are zero. And I think that's...
So let me ask you this. The argument from the city is that they don't even need to participate in this process, and that your remedy then is a bad faith. What's the, you know, is that maybe, should that be the is that what we're looking at here then? I mean, we're, how do you prove bad faith, and is that, how is that different on an unfair labor practice as opposed to conciliation?
Well, as I understand what Mr. Bogue said, he essentially said two things. That, you know, number one, I think he was conceding that it would be bad faith if they just didn't show up and ignored the entire process.
But if we say they don't need to show up, then is it bad faith?
Well, of course, certainly. I mean, if that's the way this court interprets the statute and say you don't need to, then you're right. I mean, it probably throws any kind of bad faith argument out the window. But I think there's two levels to that. You know, number one, you know, there's the idea of just, you know, showing up, you know, to, you know, basically cover yourself under the statutes, but not having any kind of, you know, openness and good faith participation in the process itself. You know, if we, you know, just showing up and saying, okay, we're done in 20 minutes because nobody's willing to change anything, you know, I mean, I would probably disagree with Mr. Bogue. I think that would probably show a bad faith participation in the process, you know, right off the bat. You know, I think...
What's your remedy on a bad faith I mean, would you have any kind of a remedy to rescind this contract under bad faith, or what would be your remedy?
Well, that might be a question of whether the Department of Labor would have that authority if they went through that procedure and found that there was a bad faith, whether they'd have a remedy to at least potentially send the parties back to the bargaining table and actually participate. You know, would it end up in the same position in the end? You know, who knows? Maybe. I mean, I don't think there's any dispute, at least from the union's perspective, that you know, some of the lack of teeth in the collective bargaining laws is something that, you know, I'm sure they'd love to address with the legislature. But as the law stands right now, possibly, I think what this court is being asked to determine and enforce is the procedure that's on the books, to at least allow them to go through this procedure, you know, in an open, fair setting, on a level playing field, where they can at least openly and honestly address the issues and attempt to reach some kind of an agreement. I think Your Honor's question to Mr. Bogue about the effect on these statutes is right on point. If we adopt the city's position here, I believe you are in effect gutting these statutes. You're gutting the legislative direction that's contained in 318.8.1. You have to presume that they incorporated the Department of Labor provisions in there for a reason. If there's no remedy, if there's no requirement that they participate in this process, you have effectively eliminated that from the statute. Again, if we look back at the school district statutes that the circuit court so heavily relied on, you know, I don't think that those say what Mr. Bogue thinks they say and what the circuit court thought they said. They impose that last best offer requirement for school districts. Okay? They do say in the statute when that last best offer has to be imposed. It has to be imposed after the mediation or the conciliation and fact-finding procedures. What that doesn't say, it does not mean that none of the Department of Labor's apply to non-school district public unions. It doesn't say that. If we go back to 318.8.1, that's the very purpose, I believe, that the legislature incorporated those Department of Labor provisions into the statute.
What about the fact that they added that later but didn't add it to the first, to point one?
Well, I think
how do we interpret that? Does it, I mean, do we even consider that? Does it mean anything?
It does mean it. I don't believe it means anything to the result of this case. I believe the proper interpretation of that is, as you know, tried to state, you know, what they have imposed in 8.2 10 years later is this requirement that once you've gone through the impasse, once you've gone through the Department of Labor, that the school district is required to impose their last best offer as a contract. I believe it has a time limit within 10 days so that the school districts are operating under that last best offer contract. I guess, as this court pointed out in the Bonhomme County case, that is an exception, or that is the change from the general negotiation law that was imposed by 8.2. It wasn't the Department of Labor procedures. It was the mandatory imposition. That was the change. The trial court read that backwards into 8.1 and said that because there's this school district exception, that none of these procedures apply to non-school districts. I think that not only guts the statute, takes out any legislative meaning to 6010.1 and 6010.2, but it also completely misreads the Bonhomme County case itself. Again, I think it's important to note that that case was a case of non-school district public employers. What the courts essentially said is, again, you know, this non-school district public employer case, the procedures we laid out on here, now only applies to school districts. And I think it's a terrible misreading of that statute. What we are asking from this court is essentially that the city be told, public employers be told, that this is a requirement. When either party requests that intervention under 318.8.1, that the department is obligated to proceed with those fact-finding and conciliation, that the parties have to participate in those, and that they're not allowed to impose a contract prior to the time that those procedures are met. We would ask this court to remand this matter to the trial court for further proceedings to remedy this situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Love. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.